Hello again. It's your host, Marissa True, and my co-host, Stu Elms, back for another episode of Tez Talks Radio. So, how are you today, Stu?
I'm well, thanks for asking. Hi, everybody.
And so, we have got a lot to cover in this week's episode. We're going to dive right in. This week's guest is Leah Callum-Butler. She is the director of Infarsis, a consulting firm focused on the role of technology in advancing economic development in Asia. And she's also a renowned CoinDesk columnist. She was also the voice behind the highly influential documentary Play to Earn NFT Gaming in the Philippines, where she uncovered how people in the Philippines were playing Axie Infinity to earn a living during the peak of the COVID-19 pandemic. And most recently, Leah was also a guest on Respawn, which was a digital event organized by the Tezos community that focused on the rise of Web3, blockchain gaming, and more. So, welcome, Leah. How are you today?
I'm great. Thanks so much for having me. Got amazing feedback after Respawn, so I was pretty stoked to come back and chat with you guys again.
No, it's our pleasure to have you.
Let's start with something we always like to hear about here on Tez Talks is our guest's journey into the crypto space. Can you tell us a little bit about how you got to where you are today?
Yeah, absolutely. So I stumbled across blockchain around 2016. My first foray into it was actually looking at energy as a use case. I spent the first 5 years of my career working in the sustainability space. So I came across the Brooklyn Microgrid, which was a consensus project, and it was the first time that they proved how energy could be shared across the blockchain between prosumers. So people who have, say, solar panels on their roof, I could produce some energy, sell it to my neighbor, donate it to the school down the road, whatever. I thought it was a super cool use case. And that was kind of where I started. Actually, the very first ICO that I ever bought into was the Tezos one.
Nice.
So
Amazing.
So I think that must have been like 2017, I think. So I've been following Tezos for a really long time. And I guess, after the energy use case, when I started learning about blockchain's probably more better known uses, which is kind of more on the financial side of things, I was just always really interested in how the technology could be used to empower groups that are currently excluded from the system or perhaps don't have the best opportunities in life like other people. And, I think that spans across a whole range of different things. My first interest was in payments, but then sort of also looking at how people could actually build wealth through crypto that they kind of didn't have access to, perhaps depending on where they were born, or the type of career that they had, or whatever the case may be. Fast forward a bit, because that kind of goes on for a bit. I actually arrived in the Philippines. You can tell by my accent, I'm Aussie, but I have been living in the Philippines since 2018. I originally came here because we had a team of devs that were working on building a crypto payments gateway. Like a lot of people, we'd been outsourcing to them for a few years, and we decided that we'd come and spend some time on the ground in the Philippines with our devs and, kind of give them a bit of training and mentorship so they could work on some of the meatier projects that we were doing around this crypto payments gateway. I didn't really know a lot about the Philippines before I got here, but it didn't take long to kind of recognize that something special was really building here. So, like back in 2018, I could already see it, something like 80% of the adult population doesn't have a bank account, but everyone has a mobile phone, everyone has a Facebook account, and people were kind of actively looking for financial alternatives. And to me, that was super exciting because it was nothing like Australia, say, where everyone has a bank account, everyone has a debit card and a credit card and access to a loan and credit, everything that they need. So I kind of felt like at home, people were resting on their laurels with innovation, whereas here in the Philippines, people were really hungry for change. So, when we actually decided to stay. So 1 month has turned into like more than 3 years now. And it's been pretty cool actually, because fast forward to 2021, I'm sure we'll dig into this a lot more throughout this conversation, but the play to earn movement really started to take off here. And for me, it was total validation of everything that we'd seen in 2018 that we just thought was a pressure cooker, like in terms of crypto adoption. We really started to see it take hold in 2021. And, you know, now I'm super proud that I was bullish on Philippines like the whole time. So I'm sure we'll dig into more of that now. So like, I won't talk about it now, but yeah, that's kind of how we got to where we are today.
Okay. Can you share a little bit about Mpharsis and how it operates?
Yeah, so we started out in late 2019 as a consulting firm. So we were kind of working with actually a lot in the regulation space. So we have a lot of experience in doing like anti-money laundering and counter-financing of terrorism regulation for crypto. And we were working with a lot of what I would say kind of traditional crypto companies like crypto exchanges and helping them a lot with their communications to stakeholders. But in 2021, after the release of our documentary, which I'm sure we'll also talk a bit about, we really pivoted into the Web3 space, focused super heavily on play to earn NFTs and the opportunity that exists in the metaverse. We've also recently pivoted more into investing. So we're looking at seed and pre-seed deals, and we provide advisory services to those projects that we've invested in. So some of the ones that we've looked at recently and actually invested in include YGGC and IndieGG, which are actually sub-DAOs or sub-guilds of the broader Yield Guild Games parent DAO, which we can talk more about DAOs later if you want. And also things like Breeder DAO. I'm not sure if you've heard of them, but they're a super interesting startup that is actually producing high-quality in-game NFT assets at scale. So they're solving a lot of the liquidity issues in terms of new NFT games that are launching in the market and don't have enough NFTs available for players. So we're really focusing on that kind of Web3 space and how NFT games can actually provide opportunities to real people, whether it be in emerging markets or really anywhere in the world.
So it sounds like Mpharsis kind of began with the mission of setting up all of the baseline infrastructure for this sort of technology to take off and is now a lot more forward-looking into seeing where the potential actually lies, given that this infrastructure is sort of being handled worldwide and it frees your hands up to sort of dabble into new areas. But to bring this back to the documentary that revealed the potential of play-to-earn gaming in developing economies, specifically the Philippines, I think a key question that is still on everyone's minds is what exactly the conditions were that made this such a pivotal moment for blockchain adoption, not just in the Philippines, but, you know, worldwide.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think there's a lot of factors. I guess just looking at the Philippines specifically, as I mentioned, it's a really mobile-first place, very digitally savvy. There's a, I think it's a Hootsuite survey that looks at social media usership across the world, and Philippines has come up number one social media users on the planet, something like 5 years in a row. So everyone has a Facebook account. But couple that with the fact that very few people have a bank account. I do think there is low trust in institutions, be it banks or governments. So people are actively looking for alternatives. And I guess the other issue as well is that, you know, in the Philippines, a lot of people don't have access to good income earning opportunities. It's very common, like we even have a word for it, OFW, which stands for Overseas Filipino Workers. People just generally have to leave home to find work overseas. And it's so ingrained, it's part of the culture. Like, you know, everybody knows that Filipinos send money home to family because there's just not enough opportunities here in the country. And I think that, you know, that's something that really struck me. Like the plight of the OFW is really heartbreaking. Like there's a lot of parents that leave their very young children behind to go and earn a living so that they can have a better life in the future. But it does break up families and they don't get to kind of develop the same relationship that they would with, you know, a parent in a normal at-home situation. So it was things like that, you know, all of these factors kind of compounding in each other. It was like, you know, the digital readiness and I think the appetite to take on these new products, but also the fact that people just had so few opportunities at home. And then you kind of meld this with the pandemic, and then people were forced to stay at home. They had a lot of time on their hands. They also had a mobile phone in their hands and an internet connection. So I think, you know, a lot of the issues with onboarding to crypto that most people come up against, people suddenly had huge incentive to spend the time, whether it be days, weeks, or months, learning how to use this technology, and also kind of handholding their friends and family along the way as well to help them onboard. So I think that was a really big shift where we saw so many people willing to kind of learn this difficult technology where most other people just would never bother, you know, jumping through those hoops. The other thing, you also just talked about infrastructure, and I think a really key thing here in the Philippines is that the Philippines has been very friendly toward crypto and fintech innovation. And we do have good regulation here. There was already a number of established central bank licensed crypto exchanges. So it really wasn't difficult for people to be able to cash in and out of crypto. A lot of people had already done it sort of back in 2017. So it certainly wasn't new. And the one other thing that I would add to that is that because there's so many unbanked, people are very accustomed to finding workarounds in terms of how you get your money out. So say like in Australia or, you know, in Europe or the US, you'd obviously just go to a bank to get money out if someone sent it to you. But here, most people don't have a bank account. So they might go to, say, a Cebuana Lulie, which is a pawn shop. You can just go there and get your cash out. You could even go to, you know, a kiosk at a local mall. Even some of the 7-Elevens do it. So people are really not, you know, there aren't the same kind of barriers in terms of some of these cash-in, cash-out hurdles that, like, most other people would see as really annoying workarounds. Here it's just kind of normal. Everyone's used to doing it.
Yeah, I think it's also characteristic of not just the Philippines, but Asia more broadly. And you touched on a lot of the key points, which are a largely unbanked population. The resourcefulness when it comes for income seeking opportunities, and especially the digitally savvy populations, which has obviously driven this massive community, like community focused support system in terms of getting everyone onboarded. But since this initial enthusiasm around, you know, I feel like play to earn gaming was sort of just the pinnacle of the opportunity in action, but it wasn't necessarily all of the activity that was going on the ground. It's just the thing that we focused on the most. But I want to ask how this space has developed since. So what new trends have emerged? You briefly mentioned gaming guilds earlier, but what else are we seeing?
Yeah. Oh my God. So much. Like play to earn really took off. So when we were creating our documentary, that was launched in May, but we were planning for it in December 2020 and we filmed it in January 2021. If I go back to like December 2020, no one knew what an NFT was. No one was talking about NFTs like anywhere. And if you just fast forward to like February, March, when the Beeple $69 million artwork was sold, suddenly everyone was talking about NFTs. So I think that, you know, when play to earn sort of came up on everyone's radar after that, whether it was sort of around mid-2021, the innovation that spurred after that has just been like an insane whirlwind. So as you mentioned, there was the rise of guilds, and really that came about because of the popularity of scholarships. And I think that is such an interesting innovation because it really demonstrates the true utility of NFTs, just like any other productive asset. And I love, you know, talking to people who don't really believe in the use case of NFTs about this, because you can just see the light bulb immediately turn on. You know, they might be like, oh, why wouldn't I just right click and save? But if you explain to them, it's like, well, you could actually buy an NFT that you could own, demonstrate ownership of, play it in a game and earn reward tokens like future cash flows, they suddenly go, oh my God, I can see now why I would want to own that digital asset. The problem was, though, that these games became so popular, also the prices of the NFTs went up. And, you know, kind of ironically, the people who were really benefiting the most from being able to earn those in-game reward tokens couldn't afford to buy the NFTs. So then this originated in Axie Infinity. The scholarship model came in. People would buy the NFTs and they might even have like a whole fleet of them, almost like owning a fleet of taxis and renting them out for other people to drive or play with. And they would simply just split the in-game reward tokens between them. Axie Infinity was the one where that model became popular because it had a super interesting aspect about it, that your private keys, you know, where your NFTs are actually held within your own wallet, was separate to the game account. So I could give you a QR code that you could use to log in and use my NFTs for time, but you couldn't actually get access to my wallet. So it's not like you could actually steal my NFTs and run away with them. So that was what made it super different. And, you know, since then, a lot of other games have come into the space and they're all sort of copying that model too. So I think scholarships and the idea of renting NFTs is here to stay. Other things that we've seen, obviously, as you mentioned, guilds have come up. So, you know, some people might just buy some NFTs that are enough for themselves, but some guilds around the world have raised incredible amounts of money to be able to go and invest in those NFTs that their member base actually wants to play with. And they can kind of hold them in a treasury and, you know, lend them out to the people who identify as part of their guild. So that's pretty cool. Here in the Philippines, we actually saw that, I think this must have been around August last year. I just did some desktop research and found like at least 50, maybe 100 small merchants that were all accepting SLP as payment. SLP is Axie's in-game reward token. And like, this was literally any kind of business. Like, you know, I found a dermatologist, a kid's toy shop, like a dumpling restaurant, a massage parlor, you know, a car repair shop, like everywhere. And I thought, yeah, it was so wild. And people were even, you know, advertising it on Facebook, like, you know, we accept SLP, yeah, choose us. And I thought this was super interesting because obviously we have been through a very difficult economic time. The people who were playing these games presented, you know, quite a wealthy portion of the population, or at least people who are able to earn. So, you know, they were a very good target market for a lot of these shops. But I went and spoke to some of the merchants who were doing it. And perhaps even more interestingly, most of the merchants who are accepting it were actually breeders in the game. So for those who aren't familiar with the game, the way that you create new NFTs is that you have to have two parent NFTs who mate, essentially, they breed to have a baby NFT. And to do that, you have to spend the in-game reward tokens as well as some governance tokens, kind of like a transaction fee to be able to produce this new NFT. So the people who were like willingly accepting this in-game reward token from their customers weren't necessarily even accepting it because they saw it as just like an equivalent of Philippine peso. They were actively seeking more of it so that they could breed more Axies, which was just like insane. So
yeah, that's absolutely fascinating, because I think whenever, you know, you see a merchant accepting a particular kind of payment method, you just think that's just to diversify how, you know, it's just making sure that the customer can pay in a way that works best and that the merchant always wins. But to see it reflected more in the notion of this is going to help me in game and advance myself in game, and see that as, I guess, more of an investment opportunity for their digital life, as it were, that's where we're really starting to see the blurring between the physical and the metaverse, right?
You are right, though. I mean, I think from the customer's point of view, the advantage of being able to pay in the currency that they earn in, be it, you know, an in-game reward token, is a huge advantage. Like, the other option is to have to switch it out. You know, you might go to Ethereum, to a stable coin, out to Philippine pesos, and you're losing transaction fees at every stage along the way. So for them, and it's also just inconvenient. So if you can buy stuff in the money that you earn in, it's definitely a huge benefit.
Absolutely. So you mentioned a bunch of factors that you sort of identified when you first got to the Philippines that make it a fertile ground for adoption of crypto technology. Do you think Asia has the potential to overtake the West in terms of broad scale adoption of decentralized technology?
Yep.
Very clean and simple answer. We like that.
Absolutely. Thank you. I think, you know, people love to talk about leapfrog innovation, and, you know, I often think it's just sort of thrown around, or they like to look at use cases in, you know, that happened decades ago. But I really feel like we're seeing it right now here in Asia. People, they're not, I guess the interesting thing about emerging economies is that they're not bogged down by legacy infrastructure. Mm-hmm. So sometimes their disadvantages are actually a huge advantage when a revolutionary new technology comes along. And that's what I think we're seeing here now. Like Web3 provides so many different opportunities, but say in places where people aren't hungry for that change, they don't necessarily have the incentive to adopt these technologies fast and to really make it a part of their life. Whereas here, it's like people don't have bank accounts, they don't have income earning opportunities. You know, they're not currently supported by great infrastructure or services or financial products. So they are actively looking to just go straight to this technology. And, you know, a lot of people aren't even really seeing the need to have any of those legacy services or products in the mix at all.
Especially if, like you said, there's lack of trust in the institutions that do exist, right?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I think that's the case in the Philippines. Like, you know, I don't get into that conversation too much because, you know, I'm a guest in this country and, you know, I don't want to talk too much about that. But, you know, I have definitely observed it that, you know, people are actively looking for any solution that is sort of removing intermediaries from the equation.
Okay. On the topic of you being a guest in the country there, as somebody who has lived in a Western culture and is now living in an Asian culture, specifically somebody operating in this arena, what do you think the Western markets misunderstand the most about the Asian markets and the people who make them work?
Two things. So I think a lot of the time people see what's happening in this region and they think, oh, we have to expand to Asia. And they don't realize that Asia is a region which is kind of like a patchwork quilt in terms of culture, language, regulation. You know, just try and compare something like Korea with Myanmar, with the Philippines, with Vietnam. Like every single country is so unique. And I think that's what makes it such a fantastic region, but it is really difficult if a company wants to expand here. They really need to look at countries individually and specifically. A blanket strategy isn't going to work, and it's probably going to leave you with egg on your face. So make sure, I think people need to make sure that they respect individual countries and cultures. And that's hard and expensive, but it has to be done. The other thing I would say that I hear all the time is, and this isn't just exclusive to play to earn, but it also applies to things like, you might have heard of business process outsourcing, BPOs. They're really big in the Philippines. It's actually how I was outsourcing my dev team when I came here to the Philippines. It's kind of like companies that set up and you can hire full-time staff mm-hmm. through them, but it's essentially an outsourced or remote team. I think for business models like that, as well as play to earn, a lot of people often say, is it exploitative? Because people are earning less. And I think it's a really, I'm glad that people ask that question because it means that they're actually sort of caring about the fact that these countries are lower to middle income countries and, you know, they do earn less. My fundamental opinion on this is that it's not exploitative. It's actually, I think, other people's duty to provide opportunities like this. You know, So I've lived here for some time. I do know that the money stretches a lot, lot further. Like if you look at things like purchasing power parity, it is just not on par. I can live in the Philippines a lot cheaper than I can in Australia, absolutely, hands down. So the money stretches a lot further. And the thing is, if you give someone the opportunity to participate in a global economy, like whether it's through providing an outsourced job so someone gets to work for an international company and get that experience and network with all of your staff, or perhaps they join a DAO and, you know, they get to interact with other people in that DAO from all over the world. You're giving people opportunity, experience, income, and from that, you know, don't underestimate them. They will take that and they will move up on their own. So I think it's absolutely not exploitative, and people should be providing as much opportunity as they possibly can, because it often doesn't otherwise exist here.
No, I think those were two very, very important points. And I loved what you said about the idiosyncrasies of the Asian market. The Asian market is not just one blanket arena the way you can potentially, you know, address a market like the United States, which is a single country that just happens to be massive. And I've always likened it to seeing Asia as almost a blockchain in itself, in terms of each country is autonomous and it's decentralized because there's no overarching governing system, but yet it still sort of works as a cohesive whole. It's kind of one of those, like the sum is greater, the whole is greater than the sum of its parts, which is where the potential in this region really is massive. But yeah, I think it's very much going to take a localized perspective in each and every single community, because it is just fundamentally different. And then I've also come across the argument as well about, you know, is this technology exploitative, especially when you look at, you know, scholarships and loaning out axes, for example, to encourage people to play. And I think it's an important question to be addressed, but exactly as you said, by offering people access to materials, give them the opportunity to build as well and build in their own way.
Just to add on that, so like I guess what I've seen here is, and how I would compare it, like Bitcoin to me has always been pay to play. You have to have some money up front to be able to invest in Bitcoin. And I think people have seen that some people have had incredible wealth creation opportunities that have been completely life-changing, but you still had to be able to invest in that technology, you know, early on. You would have had to have the education, the networks, the people to kind of introduce you to it. And you also had to have essentially money to put into it. And, you know, a lot of the people here who are attracted to play to earn, they don't have any money to spare. You know, they're struggling to put food on the table. So to kind of assume that people would even have just a little bit of money to put into Ethereum or Bitcoin, like via coins.ph or something, which is a popular licensed crypto exchange here, you know, it's actually kind of ignorant, because they don't have that money to spare, certainly not on something so risky. So the attraction to play to earn is that you can actually get into the space by contributing your time and your skill instead of money. And rather than having to buy crypto, you can earn it. And once you're kind of, you've got that foot in the door, what we're seeing is that suddenly people have this ability to be able to choose where they want to go next. Like, you know, are they going to cash out that money and feed their family with it, and perhaps they save a little bit, or if it goes up in value, you know, do they decide to put it into a staking protocol, or do they swap it out for a different kind of crypto? Maybe they even use it to buy some virtual land or real land, you know, here. But they kind of need that first step. And for me, that's what's really exciting about this particular movement, because it doesn't require money to get in, and that's what makes it so different for these people who are coming from, you know, a less privileged background.
So we've covered a lot about the opportunities that are available here, but then of course with that there's always going to be countless challenges. We touched on a few of them earlier, and these aren't unique to Asia. It's more about general blockchain adoption. So we're looking at things from, you know, off ramps, creating wallets, learning how to transact, becoming a lot more familiar with an emerging technology that, you know, even those that have been in the game for years are still wrapping their heads around to a degree. But I want to ask if there are any unique challenges to Asia. We've spoken about how there, you know, a lot, it's a region that's much better able to, you know, leapfrog, quote unquote, into these because people are just much more tech forward and willing to adopt new technologies, but what are the things that are going to hold this region back?
Yeah, I think, as I mentioned before, the uniqueness of each country does make it difficult. You know, you might see a fantastic use case for success in somewhere like the Philippines, but that's going to be really difficult to carry across to Vietnam. Like, don't quote me on that. I'm just saying as an example. But I think that is one of the most difficult things. Like, even each country has its own language. Some of them are not heavily English speaking. Like, here in the Philippines, almost everyone speaks English. And I think that also had a lot to do with the fact that people were able to adopt so quickly and rapidly because they could consume educational content online, which was made by Westerners. But, you know, that just doesn't have the same effect in somewhere like Malaysia, Thailand, Vietnam, Indonesia, where people predominantly speak other languages. So I actually think that this is an interesting challenge that, again, could be solved by, say, the Web3 community, as opposed to something straightforward like policy or regulation, which just takes too long to develop. Because we have so many content creators who are coming into the space now and who can be remunerated for their efforts in a whole range of different ways, I'm hoping that we're going to continue to see more and more tailored content that will actually come out to help onboard people that is completely tailored to their country or their region. I actually think that's kind of in keeping with blockchain's ethos around decentralization as well. Like, we don't really want, you know, one single blanket approach to it. We definitely want nuance. And that's just not, that's not only language, it's also going to depend on, well, who are the crypto exchanges in your local country and what is the usual kind of behavior around on off ramps, access and things like that. So an example I would give in the Philippines, we have Cuckoo Crypto TV. He became a crypto education creator sort of around late 2020, and he's become so popular on YouTube and Twitter. He was actually invited by the Central Bank of the Philippines to provide a one hour's talk on financial literacy and how people could get into crypto safely and securely. So to me, I just think that is such a fantastic example of how people can take the initiative, rise up, create their own content, get remunerated for it, and actually even get recognized by the authorities for their work. So that's just a pretty cool example. And I think we're going to see lots more cuckoos in other countries too.
Absolutely. If we zoom out a little bit and look at the larger picture for the region and its relationship with blockchain, you know, we've talked about the sort of mentality of the people in some of the countries there being a fertile ground for this stuff to take seed. We've talked about the fact that governments in the region seem not only to be a little bit more open to it, but to be actively embracing this new technology that's emerging. What do you think the potential is for blockchain technology to change the way that the economy works in the region?
So I really think it's about opening up borders. As I mentioned before, you know, so many people in these countries, they feel they have to leave home to find good enough work, and they send money home. Like, if you look at the stats on remittance, you know, not just global remittance, but also domestic remittance. So someone might leave their home in a rural area and move to the big city to get a job, send money home. It's just so ingrained in the culture that people have to send money everywhere in order to allow their families to survive and their kids to go to school and things like that. Before I discovered Play to Earn, that was something I was super interested in and writing a lot about in terms of how blockchain could be used to make remittances cheaper and faster and more efficient. Because, you know, a lot of people are very used to paying like 10% on remittances. And, you know, that's a lot to lose out of your pay packet if you're sending money home and it is really vital money. You know, the volume of remittances is actually something like 3 times the value of relief aid that is sent by government. So this is really critical money. I actually spoke with some OFWs a couple of years ago and asked them, like, if you didn't lose that 10% out of your pay packet, what would you spend it on? And they said, oh, I wouldn't spend it. I'd be able to take half a day off a week. So like a lot of people are having to have two jobs just so that they can keep up with this. And, you know, it's just a leaky bucket with remittance fees. So put that aside. I think what Play to Earn and Web3 has demonstrated is that people don't have to leave home to be able to find a good job. They could get a great job in the metaverse, maybe multiple jobs, and earn from home through their mobile phone. So I think that's incredibly powerful from an economy perspective as well, because, you know, you're not having this incredible inefficiency from just draining all this money on fees throughout, you know, an inefficient remittance system. You can keep that money like in the wallet of families so they can spend it on what they think is important. But then you're also kind of keeping one more seat at the table, one more breadwinner in the country who's going to be spending on stuff in their local community. So, you know, I think if we can, you know, stop breaking families up and kind of kill this idea that people have to leave home in order to find a good job, will be amazingly powerful for countries. You know, that might also help people onboard better into Web3 skills. So if you kind of think about the future economy and the kind of skills that are going to be needed, if you've got this crypto native population that just gets how to use crypto and all these brand new technologies, you've suddenly got a workforce that, you know, might be sort of solving problems in their own community using Web3 and becoming tech founders. And then you've got, you know, a flourishing tech industry that could actually be homegrown for people, you know, here in their countries. You don't see that brain drain just going to Silicon Valley or something like that. So, I mean, I'm throwing way forward into decades, but for me, it's really about allowing people to stay home. You know, if you want to go overseas, it should be a choice and you should be able to leave as an expat, not an immigrant. You know, there's this kind of weird thing where people think, oh, you're an expat. That's, you know, you're so lucky to be able to work overseas versus an immigrant who was forced to work overseas. Yeah. So I really want to see economies being able to become strong on their own because all their best people aren't leaving.
And speaking of the people who are still there and who are beginning to experiment with this stuff, I'm really curious, have you kept in touch with the people from the documentary? And is Axie Infinity still flourishing in the Philippines?
Yeah, so a couple of stories. So you might remember the elderly couple, Lola and Lolo. Quick update on them, sort of toward the end of the year 2020, their daughter was in Canada as an OFW, and she was actually laid off. She lost her job because of COVID, but couldn't fly back to the Philippines because of travel restrictions. So the elderly couple, the mum and her mum and dad, grandpa and grandpa, had been actually sending money to her in Canada to support her based off the money that they had earned playing NFT games. Yeah, so they'd totally flipped OFW model on its head, which was amazing. There was one character, Art, so his best friend, iJohn, who if anyone has read the original article that I wrote on CoinDesk, it was sort of like mid-2020 and the documentary was actually based on it. iJohn was the star of that story and I met him, mid-2020. But he was, he'd actually gone over to Japan to be an OFW. And he ended up being able to earn enough from play-to-earn games, providing scholarships and trading crypto that he realized he'd made about 3 years' earnings in the space of 3 months or something like that. He quit his OFW job and came back to the Philippines to be with his family, and he's still going. Sprocky, who was one of the managers in Axie University, if you remember those guys, he's still going strong. I'm actually catching up with him this week. YGG has a manager's summit, which he's going to. So I'm going to go down there and catch up with those guys. So they're all there. I mean, I think we get asked this question a lot because the SLP price fell dramatically over the last few months. And a lot of people kind of assume that it also means that a lot of people are leaving the game. In my opinion, there needs to be an economic rebalancing, and Sky Mavis, the creators of the game, have made some tough but I think effective decisions to be able to stop the oversupply of SLP into the economy. So it'll take time, but I think we will see that rebalance. But from my perspective, you know, the demand for scholarships, you know, new people wanting to get into these games hasn't gone down at all. If anything, it's as strong as ever. And I do think that there was a lot of tourists. Like, you kind of see this in any crypto bull run. Like, when the price goes up, you have a lot of people come in. They weren't necessarily the people who were there from the beginning. They're attracted by, you know, maybe even sort of get rich quick ideologies. And, you know, once the price goes down, they're the first to leave. But I think the OGs are definitely still there, and they kind of, you know, they've been through this before. When we were creating the documentary, it was January 2021, and the price of SLP then was 1 cent. So, you know, they've kind of been through these cycles before, and they understand that, you know, you need to prepare for it. You also need to ride it out, sort of take the highs with the lows. So,
I mean, I think it's incredible to see sort of the social impact in action and the very human and on the ground changes that are taking place because of an emerging technology. And all of those stories are amazing to hear about. And you've shared so many perspectives and so many different angles to this conversation. But to kind of close things off, I want to give you a very easy one because you've shared so much. And it's just about, you know, what of the Asia-grown projects that have actually caught your attention lately, and what is it about them that have made them significant? I remember earlier in this conversation, you mentioned a few of the DAOs that have emerged, but tell us more about them.
Okay, so full disclosure, I'm going to mention a few that we are personally invested in, but obviously we really believe in these projects and did our DD. We also got to know the team very well, so that's why we have really high conviction on these projects. Obviously, Yield Guild Games, I mentioned them. We've been working with them since early 2021, and they've grown and grown to become the benchmark for performance on DAOs, in my opinion. And they've had incredible investors like Delphi Digital, A16Z, Bitcraft out of Europe. For A16Z, it was actually the first time that they had invested in a Philippine-led project in the crypto space. So that was a really huge success story for people in the Philippines as well, because a lot feel like the Philippines is overlooked in terms of its innovation potential. In this region, you know, people always look to places like Japan and Singapore, even Vietnam and Indonesia as innovation hotspots, but the Philippines is like rarely mentioned. So Yield Guild Games was really the one that kind of put the Philippines on the map and turned heads globally. I would also say Vietnam is incredible right now in terms of the blockchain gaming innovation that is coming out of there. Axie Infinity was obviously the one that kind of kicked that off, but there are other games coming out now like Cypher, that's S-I-P-H-E-R, Cyball, C-Y, Ball, and Thetan Arena. Like, there's so many different games coming out of there. And I actually just did a tweet thread about this the other day because I was like, why Vietnam? Like, if the Philippines is kind of like the epicenter for play-to-earn adoption, why is Vietnam the place where all these games are being made? And I was actually able to link it back to some wartime policy that prioritized education, and particularly education in the sciences, as one of their absolute top priorities. And you can kind of trace this back and see now how children who grow up in Vietnam end up becoming the region's highest performers in school. So they've just become like this powerhouse of producing really, really smart and talented kids. So keep an eye out for Vietnam. I mentioned BreederDAO before. So I think people are still catching on to BreederDAO because I think it's a really new concept and people aren't quite sure what they do, but they see themselves as like a production factory in the metaverse for high quality NFT assets. So if you think about something like Axie Infinity, when the game first launched, it was like back in 2018. So they've had years for people to be breeding Axies, adopting, you know, kind of getting into it. It's been sort of a slow burn for a couple of years. But other games that are just launching now, there's huge demand from day one, like particularly in terms of these guilds. You know, they're bringing thousands, perhaps, you know, potentially millions of players on day one, and they need NFTs, you know, whether they're being sold wholesale in the secondary market so that people can actually play the game. Reader DAO is designed to solve that problem. So they can produce NFTs for whether it's Axie, Peg Axie, Krabata, Crypto Unicorns, all of these NFT-driven games, and help these games kind of make sure that they have liquidity in terms of the NFTs that are needed to play from day one. So really like them. And one more, XLD Finance is a really interesting one too. So, you know, if I was going to describe it in a really simplified way, so I am like really simplifying it down, but it's kind of like a GCash, like we have that in the Philippines. It's a mobile payment solution, but it's a MetaMask login. So no email, no bank account linked. It's linked directly to your crypto wallet, and you can pay for anything you need, whether it was like phone bills or flights or whatever you're buying online. But it's MetaMask login, and they've got listings of all the in-game reward tokens. So, you know, we were talking about merchants accepting SLP in the Philippines. They were kind of doing that proactively and having to manage all the, you know, difficult back-in and Forex, I guess, themselves. XLD Finance handles all of that and just makes it possible for people to pay with crypto via MetaMask. So that one's pretty cool as well.
Very cool.
So much happening in the space to be excited about, especially in this region. And I think it's a region that's often overshadowed. So to shine, you know, a beacon on it is just been fascinating throughout this conversation. And Leah, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to share all of this. I think there's so much that people can take notes on. I've definitely started to take a few notes. I'm sure Stu has as well.
Fantastic stuff.
So, yeah, I just wanted to say massive thank you, and hopefully we'll have you back on again soon.
Thanks for having me. It's been really fun. Great questions.
All right.